taking a fresh look at it, and we're really going to center in on those specific verses that Jalen read for us. I want to talk about the clear pursuit of God that is modeled in this. I want to talk about how Jesus is always going levels deeper than we think he is or than we want him to, and then the response that he's always calling forth from us. So the pursuit of God, how he goes levels deeper, and then the response he calls us to. And so the pursuit of God. The entire way that these opening verses are told to us are meant to set the context with as much tension as possible. Now, when Jesus learned that the Pharisees, these are religious teachers and leaders, influential religious people of that time, or what the Pharisees are, had heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee. Judea is where Jerusalem is. It is the capital city of Israel at that time. It is where everything goes down. It is, at that time, religiously, culturally speaking, the city that doesn't sleep, right? Like, it's the New York City of its day. It's where things happen. It's where culture and religion was shaped. And Jesus has spent some time there. But now he finds out that those in authority there are beginning to be a bit rankled, that his profile is beginning to increase, that he's gaining fame and influence, that people are starting to listen to his message. And the reason why it mentions John, who is John the Baptist here, is because John the Baptist had gone before Jesus, and it said, there's one coming greater than me. And John the Baptist's story does not end well when it comes to these religious leaders. They had arrested him, said, hey, you're causing too much trouble. And ultimately, he's actually beheaded. And so now Jesus comes, and they start putting together, oh, this is probably the one that John the Baptist was talking about. And so in some ways, what's interesting about this little parenthetical mention that he leaves precisely because Jesus was making and baptizing more disciples than John is to say that this is a moment at the height of Jesus's popularity. This is Jesus's moment. This is like when Jesus would, you know, this is his shot to go on Good Morning America. This is his shot to do all the talk shows. This is his shot for Colbert, right? Like, this is his moment where his profile is increasing and everyone is saying, man, this is what the powers that be are talking about. And you would think that this is the moment where Jesus, if frankly he were like the rest of us, which praise God he's not, would cash in on, hey, this is my time. This is when I get to be in the public eye, get to share my message, get to be a person of influence. And what's interesting is counter to what we would expect. And I love that that the gospel writer here, and the gospel is just a mini biography of Jesus. So this is the Gospel of John. That's why his name is on it. It's one of Jesus' earliest followers. In fact, we get the sense that this is Jesus' very best friend who tells this version of it. I love that he's defensive, that John's defensive of his best friend. He says, although Jesus himself did not baptize, but only his disciples, he's like, even the controversy was nonsense, which just reminds me of our moment. He's like, they didn't even get right what made Jesus controversial. I just love that. He's like, he wasn't going around baptizing, trying to show up John, whatever, but it's just kind of there. But even that parenthetical statement is meant to say, look, he's the talk of the town, and there's all different things being said about him, right? I think partially why we get that is not only is his influence rising, but there's all this misunderstanding about who he is. They're not even getting the facts right of who he is. Again, this is clearly Jesus' moment to be in the public eye, to clarify, this is who I am and what I've come to do. And counter to our expectations, which we will see again and again in this passage, he leaves Judea and departed again for Galilee. Galilee is in the north. Galilee is not where you go in order to have your name and face in the public eye, right? This is like, I don't know, leaving New York City to go to, trying to think of a town that wouldn't insult anyone, somewhere in upstate New York that no one really knows about, right? That's the choice that he's making here. What I love is what it says in verse 4, and he had to pass through Samaria. What is Samaria? Samaria is this region in between the southern region of Judah and this northern region called Galilee. Right in the middle is Samaria. And as many of you have heard us say time and time again, Samaria is this incredibly complicated place for a Jewish person to interact with, because Samaria was known to be the place where Jewish people who had been carried off into exile as part of the story of God's people, they've been carried off and conquered and brought to these other places. Some of those Jews had come back and kind of maintained their way of life and rebuilt the city, begun to rebuild the temple, all these things, kind of maintain the purity of the religion of Judaism. But then there are these Samaritans who came back and brought with them some of the practices of their conquerors and tried to kind of make a blend of these religions. And so these were, to use the very fancy word for it, these were syncretists. These were, to use a not as fancy word, these were the sellouts of the people of God. And so Samaria was this place full of, right, there's ethnic difference here. They were seen as a different people group altogether. They were seen as impure and no longer part of the pure people of God. So there's ethnic things, there's religious things, there's moral things going on here. There's historical strife that has gone on between the Samaritan people and the Jewish people. And it stands right in the middle of this place. What's fascinating about this phrase that Jesus had to go through Samaria is that, strictly speaking, geographically, he did not. In fact, very few Jewish people, for all the reasons that I just said, would actually use Samaria as the gateway between Judah and Galilee. Instead, they would take not even a scenic route. They would take a perfectly reasonable route. If I had a map and had thought of it and didn't already have 27 slides, I would have put it up here. But right along the Jordan River, there's this beautiful path that you would take, and you would kind of circumvent Samaria so that you didn't have to be with those people, and you could get from Judah to Galilee. So why does it say that Jesus had to pass through Samaria? This phrase, had to, is a very simple Greek word. It's just our equivalent of the letters D-E-I, D-A, is how you say that, D-A, D-A. And D-A in, I think I'm saying that right, in John's gospel especially, is just packed with meaning. In just the prior chapter, you have several instances of D-A that shows up. Jesus is having a conversation with another man at the exact opposite end of the religious spectrum. He's having a conversation with this man named Nicodemus, part of the governing, ruling religious authorities. Couldn't be more different than the woman we're about to meet. And he says in verse 7, for instance, you must be born again. You must be born again. Dia, must be born again. In verse 14, he says, as Moses lifted up in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man, speaking of himself in his crucifixion, so must Dia, the Son of Man, be lifted up. In verse 30, famously, John the Baptist says, he must, Dia, increase, but I, Dia, must decrease. Jesus must go through Samaria. What theologians and grammar people call this in the Gospel of John is the divine imperative. The divine imperative. This is not just a must in the sense of sort of everyday mundane obligations you have. This is something divinely ordained by God that has purpose behind it, that is absolutely essential to the purpose and plan of God. Jesus had to go through Samaria. So he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. I'm tempted to re-preach that passage, but we've done that before. But this is a place of, what's interesting is, I'll try not preach the whole thing, but this is a place of historical religious significance to the Jewish people that has ended up in the middle of this very tainted, impure place. You see that? It's part of the reason why this is mentioned here. Jacob's well was there. Boom. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. Sixth hour is in their times, not 6 a.m. or 6 p.m., different kind of way of telling time. Time was told from basically sun up to sundown. So sun up plus 6 hours, what time is it about? Yeah, it's about noon, right? It's the sun is at its peak. All of these details are told to build the tension of the interaction that's about to happen. And all of these details come back to that very simple three-letter word, dia. That this has been divinely set up and ordained by God. One interaction with one person, as opposed to a city that collectively is on the edge of its seat, waiting to hear from this one that has emerged as kind of the buzz, the talk of the town. Instead, Jesus leaves all of that, makes his way to an unlikely place in the middle of nowhere with all kinds of complicated history, morality, all different kinds of things. And he's weary as he does. I think we're told that he's weary here. Very, very rarely are we told that Jesus is weary. Normally when we are, especially in John's gospel, you got to keep in mind, John's gospel, this is Jesus' very best friend. There's no detail here that's out of place. There's nothing, the different gospels are told in different ways. Like the gospel of Mark is much more boom, boom, boom. It's an efficient gospel. It's just trying to tell you the story. John's gospel is just about every word is loaded with significance. A lot of the gospels were written like really quickly after life of Jesus. Gospel of John is a life's work. He finally publishes it towards the very, very end of his life. This is a man who lived a long time, probably 60, 70 AD or so that this is released. Jesus is killed in about 30 AD. Right? He's decades in the making. So when he tells us he's weary, why is he telling us this? I think it's why he tells us every other detail in this opening scene as he sets the stage for this interaction is to say that there is cosmic, divine intentionality behind this interaction, behind this encounter. That Jesus has exercised every single ounce of power and authority of foreknowledge that he has in order to make this interaction come about. That this is not coincidence. This is not happenstance. This isn't, oh, wow, look at Jesus. He took a really cool opportunity to have an interesting conversation. No, he left the glitz and glamour. He left his moment in the spotlight in order to find a dusty, forgotten spot in the middle of the most forgotten, in fact, despised place. And he meets, of all people, a woman there. This very last detail that he meets her at high noon is also significant because you will not find women at a well at high noon. Why? Because you go to the well to draw water for all of your days, everything, for your work, for your hygiene, for your family's well-being. So when would you think that you tend to go and get your water? In the morning, first thing in the morning. And guess what? What normally happens is that the whole town goes out together so that you can help each other, and you're probably pulling various kinds of things that help you bring more. And so there's wagons being brought, right? Get this image of the whole town going out. Now here is this woman who at high noon, for reasons that we will soon discover, is slinking off on her own, alone, with no one to help her. And she finds a man sitting, weary, at this spot, where I guarantee you she has gotten very used to not a soul being within shouting distance of. What she doesn't know is that the one sitting there is the creator of heaven and earth, is the one through whom God created galaxies and quasars and black holes. And not only has he come all the way from Judah, which would be spectacular enough, which would be surprising enough, he has come all the way from the comforts and privileges of heaven itself. And he sits in a spot waiting for this one individual with a particular story, with a particular burden, with a particular need, with a particular name. The pursuit of God could not be more obvious in this story. Why do I say this? It's because Jacob's Well does not exist because we are great seekers and pursuers of God. Jacob's Well, any church, any Christian exists solely and entirely, not just primarily, but solely and entirely because of the grace and the pursuing mercy and love of a great God who left heaven's comforts and came all the way down and makes himself available to people in dusty, forgotten, strange places like Central, God bless it, New Jersey, in the United States of America, people with stories as complicated as yours, with pasts as thorny, as rebellious, as broken as yours and mine. And he sits and he waits to have an interaction like he has with this woman. The pursuit of God always comes first. Check out this interaction. A woman from Samaria came to draw water. A woman from Samaria. A woman was not to talk to a man in public. This was not how things were done. A Samaritan was not to talk to a Jewish person in public. A Jewish person didn't even belong in Samaria. Samaritan woman came to draw water. Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. See, do you see the intention there? You guys go buy food. I'm going to sit here. What? I'm going to sit here. Why? Just come with us. We're getting lunch. We're going to go grab Wawa. Right? Like, why would you sit here? Just go. How is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? Do you see? She knows all these dynamics. This isn't just here in the text. She's hyper aware in this moment. Somehow she puts together, maybe it could have been the way he dressed, maybe it could have been something. Very quickly she puts together, oh, there's all kinds of things. There's all kinds of barriers between us, and I can feel them immediately. What's happening right now? And then just in case we didn't get it, for Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water?" Now, she's thinking he's talking physical provision. Living water, right, at that time, you have well water, which is like still water. It's there. You go, you draw it up. That's what Jacob's well was. You go in, you pull it up. Living water is what? Yeah, it's like a stream or something. It's what, you know, the absolute most exclusive properties of that time would have in their backyard, right? It's like the old school Poland Spring water bottles. Remember when those were like super cool? Now we just trash the environment by getting 37 water bottles or whatever, but I do it too. But, right, like we're so used to water, you can't wrap your brain around how mind-blowing it would be to have a source of living water. Now, also what living water here means is living water is water that's always moving, that's sourced by something, normally like up in a mountain, right? Like I always think of the super cool thing on the back of the Fiji water that explains why it's especially amazing because it originates in the whatevers and then comes down through the rocks and the minerals and it picks up the taste and all that stuff, right? And then it's moving, so it's not still, so nothing can grow in it. There's no algae, there's no bacteria, right? Like it's constantly kind of the best that they knew of kind of filtering itself at all times. She's like, "You know a spot? Where's that spot? Then I wouldn't have to come here. Hook me up. Like, you know where the living water is. Like, I need this. Here I am in the middle of the day. I don't really want to explain. Please don't ask. Please don't ask. Please don't ask why I'm here at high noon. But if you know a living water spot, like, hook me up." Woman said to him, "Sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water?" She's like, "So you know where living water is. You want me to get you a drink from here. By the way, you don't have your Yeti, right? Like, what's the deal? You didn't come prepared. Do you want me to use my stuff? Is that what you're saying? Like, you're telling me you know where living water is. You want me to use my bucket to actually quench your thirst." Like, this just gets weirder. Then she asked him just one of the best questions anyone asks Jesus. "Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock." I think that there's like a little humor there. Are you greater than our father Jacob? Jesus is like, "Yeah, before Abraham and Jacob was, I am, created the world. No big deal. Yes, I'm better than Jacob." But Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never be thirsty again." You got to keep in mind, she's not ready for like a deep intellectual symbolic conversation, right? The water that I will give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water, right, so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water." He says, "I'll give you something that will quench your thirst." She says, "Okay, I don't know what you're talking about a lot with the eternal life, but if you know where living water is and I don't have to come out here and bear the shame of all of this, trek out here, hope absolutely no one sees me as I leave the city. Hope no one sees me on the way home with my big well, with no wagon behind me, no one to help me. If you know where that is, I'll take it absolutely." Jesus said to her, this is like wild, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You're right in saying I have no husband. If you have had five husbands, and the one you now have is not your husband, what you have said is true." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." She says, "My greatest need is the shame that I feel coming out here to have to draw water. If you know where living water is, tell me where it is. Then at least I have the physical provision of water and I don't have to deal with the shame. And Jesus says, as amazing as that provision would be, I have something deeper for you. Jesus is always going to go a level deeper than you want him to. His work is always going to chisel a little bit more than you're comfortable with. His challenge in your life will always be precisely in the area that you want to keep hidden from him. And yet his greatest healing, salvific work, redemption, will only come if we actually respond to when he goes there with us. It's the lesson here. She says, I need physical water and I need not feel the shame. I need to not feel the shame that I feel every time I come out here. And what he does as the interaction goes on, what we understand is he reaches forward and he puts his finger on literally this woman's greatest hurt and pain and shame. And he says, I know that you think that that's your biggest need. You actually have a need that goes levels deeper. Now, there's a lot of conversation about what's going on here with her five husbands and all that. It seems like there's two options. Either she is a woman who has given herself to all these different kinds of men and been unfaithful and adulterous in all of these ways and is constantly running around. It also seems like there's a lot of scholars who say probably the more obvious thing in the ancient world for a woman who has had five husbands is this is a woman who has been cast off by many men who maybe had an obligation to her according to various laws of that time, and they just kind of kept handing her along. So this could be Jesus calling out her deepest area of the way that she's sinned and been rebellious against God and found her ultimate hope and meaning in men and in other things, little ears in here, right? Like, or it's him actually putting his finger on the ways in which she's been most sinned against and most cast aside. Here's what I'll say is almost either of those is some combination of both, right? Like Jesus is always going after both the sin in our own lives and the ways in which we have been sinned against, right? Like our brokenness is almost inevitably some combination thereof. I wonder if that's why we're not told exactly what's going on here. But Jesus says, that's where your brokenness lies and that's where your greatest healing will be found. And so she's very focused on if you can situationally, circumstantially take care of this thing in my life that feels like the biggest weight on my shoulders, then I'll be good. I don't know what all this mystical talk you're doing is, but like if you could provide me that, I'm good. And instead, Jesus says, no, I actually want to go to the place that you have concealed from everyone, the place that has driven you to thinking that this is your greatest need. Because it's not, because you've gotten so used to building your life around the avoidance of this thing that has happened to you that you have done, that I want to go after that thing and actually provide what only I can provide for that thing so that your life can now be built around me and not this area of deepest shame, pain, and rebellion. He does this in like five sentences, right? Like, this is Jesus. This is Jesus. This is what he's always doing, right? He pursues us. He sets up moments where we get eye to eye with him. And then in our own brokenness, in our humanness, we say, Jesus, here's what I need. And if you would only take care of this circumstance, this situation, this pain, this shame in my life, then I will be good. And Jesus says, yeah, I see that, but there's a level deeper. Because I want you to be able to endure all of life's circumstances with a sense of belovedness, with a sense of having been forgiven, with a sense of having been healed. You see, Jesus is not about circumstantial, situational salvation. He is about soul-level salvation. He is about ultimate forgiveness. He is actually about bringing full healing to the areas of our life that we believe are beyond forgiveness or healing. That's what he's doing with this woman. That's what we audaciously want Jacob's Well to be about. We want people to say that Jacob's Well was a place where barriers were broken such that life-changing encounters with Jesus might happen. It's our vision. Breaking barriers to encounter Jesus together. We want ourselves to submit to the barrier-breaking work of Jesus in our own lives. And then we want to participate and go out and say that the world says that a Samaritan and a Jewish person have no dealings. The world says a man and a woman shouldn't be seen in public, right? And we have all kinds of our own version of this in 2022 America. God help us, do we have so many versions? Whoa, 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 those don't have interact. And I won't just go naming them. You got plenty of them in your mind right now, right? Like whatever your echo chamber is on Facebook and the other people's echo chamber is, those are barriers that Jesus says, nonsense, my work transcends and goes beyond and can unite those kinds of people. Can unite historic, moral, ethnic, racial, political barriers. And he says, these are not things to be circumvented by my people. These are not things to take the easy path and say, along the Jordan, it's really scenic and you won't even have to interact with those people. He says, no, you must go to Sychar in Samaria and specifically to Jacob's Well. This is who we want to be. We want to say, yeah, some other communities take the easy path. They've done it for centuries, right? This is not hating on any church. We do this in our own hearts. This is our tendency. We want to say collectively, what if we grabbed each other and said, no, we must go through Samaria. We must do this because if we won't, who will, right? We must be people who can say, we're not a church that, right? Today is Sanctity of Life Sunday and tomorrow is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Most churches say you got to choose which one. Which one are you? Because if you care about sanctity of life, then you're not the kind of person who's going to care about wokeness, right? If you care about justice, then be careful about these more, you know, conservative values that you might have. You don't want to be associated with that. We want to say, no, 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 barriers, right? We want to be an and people, not an either or people, right? We're to be people who say, we refuse to see those barriers and say, we choose this side. We want to break those barriers and to say, no, Jesus wants to encounter us in all of the tension and complexity of those broken barriers. He wants to meet us at Jacob's Well, and he wants to put his finger not on their deepest source of pain and shame. He wants to put it on ours and say, this is what you need to hear, right? A lot of people say things to me like, well, you talk to, you're always going after the kinds of things that I tend to think, and you don't go after them enough. You know why I do that? Because I just read someone on Twitter who said this. I'm your pastor. So we're going to break the barriers that are here. And we're going to talk about that stuff, even though it's really hard and complicated, because we must go through Samaria. Die. There's a die that God has placed upon our community that we take utterly seriously. And it's really hard and scary and exhausting. It's wearying. If Jesus was weary taking that journey to Samaria, not taking the scenic route, the obvious route, we're going to be weary. Guess what he offers us in our weariness? Living water, right? What a beautiful image. Jesus, if you're going to ask us to run and sprint a really hard race, guess what we're going to need along the way? Bah, bah, right? Like a marathoner. We're going to need water. We're going to need living. We're going to need the good stuff. Like bring out the Fiji, right? Jesus says, this is what I offer uniquely. If you will let me go as deep as I want that nourishment to go. Because there is a response that he expects from us. If you jump down to the last part of what Jalen read. The woman said, I know that Messiah is coming. He is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things. Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. Just then his disciples came back. They marveled. They marveled that he was talking with a woman. But no one said, what do you seek? Why are you talking with her? I love this because even already, it's pretty early in the gospel, right? We're in chapter 4. Even already, they're like, don't ask. He's got something that he's, right? Like, Jesus' work is always surprising, a little bit crazy, a little bit hard, a little bit, wait, what are we doing, right? Like, I like that. I want us to maintain that godly Christ-like edge to say, wait, we're going there? We're going there. Yeah, this is what, let's get used to it, right? Like, let's go get used to messy, complicated places. So no one even says anything. They're like, all right, he'll explain it later, I'm sure, right? So the woman left her water jar and went away into town and said to the people, come see a man who told me all I ever did. Can this be the Christ? And of course, the answer is yes. This is the Christ. This is the Savior. See what she does? Every detail matters. This is Jesus' best friend. He's taken 30 years to tell this story. What does she do? What's the detail that stands out there to you? She goes back into the town. That's one part of it. What's significant about that? Here she is, right? Every day. Trying to sneak through town. She's got her water jug. Trying not to be seen. None of the other women will go with her. She has this encounter. She goes back like, hey! Hey! Everybody! I just met a man who told me everything that I ever did. What's everything she ever did? Is that her resume? Is that a compliment? Is that something that she would want put on a billboard in that town? She's done everything she can to avoid everyone knowing everything she ever did. Now she says, he knows it all. Why does she say he knows it all? She says, he knows more than the rest of you do. And the rest of you have shunned me. He was out there waiting for me. He was out there waiting just for me. Did you guys see him this morning? I thought not. He was there at the sixth hour. He told me everything I ever did, but what? But he offered me something in exchange. Do you see how this whole thing begins with Jesus asking her for something? Isn't that interesting? Like, the one who invented water figured out H2O, right? Like, he came up with water. He's like, oh, give me water. Why? Jesus will always ask something of you. He's always asking something of you. That's what can get tiring about being his disciple. He's always asking. He's always bringing up more stuff. He's always challenging us. He's always convicting us. But what does he say? He says, if you knew the one who is asking what? Back in verse 10, Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have what? Asked him and he would have given you living water. What's he saying there? He's saying, first of all, if you knew the gift of God, by the way, gift of God, that word gift, anybody have a guess of what kind of concept biblically that's associated with gift of God? Gift, gift, gift. Grace. Very similar concept. He's saying, if you understood how grace works, you would understand that there is always an imbalance between what I ask for and what I give. Always an imbalance. Grace is getting what you don't deserve. He says, so if I ask you for something, believe me, there's a return on investment that will absolutely blow your mind. He's saying, if you understood the grace of God and who it is that is asking something from you, you would have turned right around and asked him. This is the audacity of being a follower of Jesus, is every time he asks something of you, we're to get in used to saying, Jesus, if you're asking that of me, what are you giving me so that I might walk in that? It's a massive concept in the New Testament, is that every single command of God comes with a provision of God. Jesus never asks us to do something he will not meet us and equip us to do. And often he will give us more than we can imagine if we will ask of him, if we will ask. Right? And so Jesus will ask things of you individually. He's asking things of us corporately. He's asking a lot of us right now with COVID. Right? Like, he's asking a lot of us in this political moment. He's asking a lot of us in a lot of the mental health issues that all of us individually, corporately, at a societal level are struggling with. And he says, if you knew the one who is asking this of you, there is provision that I want to give you, but it's not out there. It's not in the broken cisterns of this world. It's not in vegging out again to Netflix and Instagram and TikTok. It's me. What you need is, if you knew the one who is asking this of you and how grace works, you would be asking way more of me. She gets it. She gets, he called me out on everything that I ever did. Went into, you get the sense that the conversation got pretty detailed from there. And you also get the sense that he sends her back with a sense that it's all taken care of. Not that it doesn't matter, but that somehow all of that has been met with grace and forgiveness and healing and belonging, such that she goes back and says, come see a man who told me everything that I ever did. And I think we can fill in the rest. And yet loved me in spite of it. And yet forgave me for all of it. Healed me for everything that I feel. Is there any evidence that her shame has been dealt with? What more evidence? She's running back. And she's like in the town square, like everybody, right? What's the other detail that we get here? She runs back to town. What's the other thing we're told? She left her water jar. Why do you think we're told that? The thing she thought she needed most doesn't even matter. You want to use my water jar to get water when you know where living water is. You can't use my jar, right? There's a virus going around, right? Like, you can't use my jar. Now, whatever happens in this interaction, she drops it. She drops it. She runs all the way back to town. She left her water jar. So often the life of faith is so hard, right? Like, it's so hard. It's so hard. This woman has lived through years with this pain, with the shame, with her sin, with whatever is going on here, right? And this is not to minimize that at all. But Jesus finally gets her attention, finally gets eye to eye with her. And her shame is dealt with, and he totally and completely redefines what her deepest need is. Now, not just redefines it, he meets it. Such that more what felt to her like her deepest need, she identifies this is a surface need. There's plenty of jars in the world. Plenty of time for water. What I've found is something greater. And what has she found? What she's found is what she points them to. Notice what she points them to. She doesn't say, come, see a religious set of teachings that have changed my life. Come see a bunch of rules. Come see a worldview that makes coherent intellectual sense. Come what? See a man. It's all about Jesus. Without Jesus, none of this is possible. We want to be Jesus people. Our vision is that we would be a church known over the years for breaking barriers, dia. There would be a dia about our church. Breaking barriers such that others might not encounter us, might not encounter the glory that is participation at Jacob's Well. Right, like, let me dispel all of that now, right? Like, we're just as messy as everybody else. What we do have, though, is a person that we can point you to. And it ain't me. It ain't Jacob. It's one greater, way greater than either of us. Come see a man who can actually meet your greatest need if you would let him, if you get eye to eye with him for long enough. So that's what we want to be about. We want to have a sense of urgency about us, but we want it to all be so that we might encounter Jesus in life-giving ways. And we do this together. So this is a together project, right? We're not lone rangers in all of this. What kind of culture does this lead to? I happened upon this week, and I was like, this is just too good not to read. This is from a fantastic book called Prayer in the Night by a woman named Tish Warren. She's an Anglican priest. And it's a beautiful book about just kind of how to process heavy stuff in the life of faith. And there's one point where she says, she's actually quoting Rich Mullins. Do any of you know who Rich Mullins is? I like the Yelp, right? Rich Mullins is old school. That's an old school acknowledgement Yelp. Rich Mullins wrote these great songs back in the day. So she quotes him at first, and then she comments on it. She says, I never understood why going to church made you a hypocrite. Because nobody goes to church because they're perfect. And just where it says church, I'm going to put in Jacob's Well. If you've got it all together, you don't need to go. You don't need to be here. You can go jogging with all the other perfect people on Sunday morning. Every time you come here, you're confessing again to yourself, to your family, to the people you pass on the way here, to the people who will greet you at the door, usually Jenkins Somer, our director of connections, that you don't have it all together and that you need our support. You need our direction. I need your direction. You need some accountability. You need some help. The ones Jesus calls are the weary ones. This is what connected it to the passage for me. Anybody weary? Isn't that a good word for right now? The ones who snap at those they love after a long day, the ones who battle addiction, the ones who aren't who they wish they were, the ones who know they're not strong, the ones who wrestle and repent, who fail and fail again. This is Jacob's Well. These ones through whom, though, Jesus is strong. I don't know that we're there. I hope everything we do gets us closer, though. That we would not be a church of perfect people. Because there's only one perfect one. He's the one we're going to point you to. And that's Jesus. And the rest of us, by even coming here, are admitting we need what he alone offers. Amen? Amen. Amen. let's get super practical. What are our strategic priorities in this minute? We got to do it. Go to the next slide. Our big theme for this year was the reality, and we've said this for 2 years now, is that this whole COVID thing, everything that's happened politically, everything that's happened racially, all this stuff, right? We said at the very beginning of it, there's very wise counsel we received from outside our community. Don't see this as a blizzard, right? A blizzard, the image on there, you shovel yourself out, you get through it, you blast through it, you snow blow it, whatever, right? And then you're done with it. We all thought that, right? Like, we all thought that's what COVID was, right? Like, I can so distinctly remember, like, they're canceling school this week, and then the next week, like, they're doing virtual. What even is that, right? We didn't know what Zoom was 2 years ago. Wasn't a blizzard. Wasn't even a winter, right? Because the winter lasts for a few months, and then the seasons just roll over. The transition out of it is pretty easy. There's one thing that I can say is the transition out of COVID has not been easy, right? Instead, not blizzard, not winter, what did we say it was? This guy, right? This is what we got. And yes, I'm very proud of that. But like, is there a better depiction of what we got instead, right? I don't even know what type of animal. Does anybody know what type of animal that is? That's what that is? Oh, okay, very angry at me. So this sloth, right, it's an ice age. And what an ice age is if and when you do emerge from it, you emerge into a fundamentally different climate. This is what we're trying to take very seriously. We don't know what we're emerging into, which is why we continue to kind of operate like 3 months out. We don't have the audacity to say like, in 2023, we will, right? Like, no, we're going to plan about, we're planned till about Easter right now. And that's kind of our mindset. And we're trying to adapt to a very new climate that we're in with all of its unique challenges, but also some of its opportunities. So here's what we said we're doing this year. Is kind of our overriding theme was from disconnection to reconnection. One thing that we know that the blizzard, the winter, and the emerging ice age did is it disconnected us, that we were a very fragmented community, just like any community, but we felt this in a particular way as a church. So we wanted to begin to be very intentional about providing opportunities for us to reconnect. What that meant, first and foremost, was the deepening of our discipleship, and so show that graphic on the next one. We went to this new format. We've done these 3 years of a church-wide format for discipleship, a comprehensive, holistic look at all the different ways that Jesus calls us to himself, wants to form us into his image and all these various aspects of life. We've maintained that core curriculum. How many of you did a 101 in the fall? 6 of you. Okay, more like 35 of you, but that's okay. Right, like some of you finished up the core curriculum as of the fall and are now what we call in the biz a 201 eligible. How many of you took a 201? So these are kind of advanced courses building off of what the 101 did. For this coming semester, that's what we're going to do. You'll hear about this over the next couple weeks. We'll be rolling out what those 101 courses will be and then also what the 201 offerings will be. Really, really excited about this. Discipleship team has been eagerly, earnestly working on this for weeks now to put something together for the spring. So we're going to do this again, and we're just going to kind of keep getting a feel for what's good in this, what could we improve in this, what are maybe some of the pitfalls of doing this model, but we feel like it's well worth continuing to flesh this out for the foreseeable future. So that was the first strategic priority. It's kind of deepening discipleship, connecting us together. I hope that whether you were in a 101 or a 201, maybe the virtual options were a little tough to do this, but my sense was if you were in a 101 or 201, especially in person, that there was probably a greater sense of connection than when we were, 27 tables in this room. That was part of our hope for the fall semester. I see some shaking heads, which is encouraging to me, so thank you for that. Next thing that we talked about was widening community. So the choice that we had made, right, that over the years here at Jacobswell, we'd always done community because we're so spread out geographically. We'd always done community more kind of geography-based. But we felt like widening community, giving you lots of opportunities just to be with the church kind of as a whole was important heading into this year. So that's why we've been doing community meals. That's why all the events that we've done are church-wide events, because we just feel like we just need to be together. There's something healing, right? Like if COVID has taught at least me anything, it is the unbelievable urgent need for embodied community, like to actually be with people in person, right? Your kids probably feel this. Our kids feel this. They've been virtual just a whole bunch through this whole thing, right? There's something about embodied community. So that's why we did those. Shout out to Mike Freiberger and Christy Ellison, who have just been doing a great job of coming up with more ideas for that. Those of you who are at the game night, really would encourage you to come to the Sabbath dinner this coming Friday. By the way, the idea there is that kids would be with us for the meal itself, and then the child cares so that the adults can do a little bit of a deeper conversation for the last hour and a half of it. I was asked about allergies and will that be taken care of, and I'm sure Mike, he's laughing back there, I'm sure he'll give that thought, maybe starting now. We'll think through. What's that? Oh, it is on the form? Look at that. It's on the form. Morgie. Thank you. Christy. Where's Christy? Is Christy here? She's in Wellkids. What a servant. Okay, so we're going to keep doing stuff like that. Expanding care, right? This is the care team. Shout out to Chris Radonovich, Rachel Suarez, who's probably out there somewhere, and Bina Thomas, who have been giving leadership to our care team. This is the care form. This is an opportunity. Just talked to someone this week who boldly, courageously reached out through the care form and is receiving care from our church that we just would not have known about otherwise. And so we're going to keep trying to find ways. That care team does a beautiful job of, when those needs are expressed, reaching out, praying for you. They've prayed several times already this ministry year for those, which is a beautiful thing. The real challenge is, are we willing to actually be known in the ways that we're invited to be known? But really appreciate what that team is doing, right? A huge part of that care is also on us as elders, and as hopefully our elder team continues to grow. By the way, Obed Aviles, putting him in front of the church right now, if you haven't responded or want to send encouragement, again, see the various emails that went out this week. I think his story, he and Melly and their kids, there's still sheets out there if you want to grab those, get to know who Obed is. But right, the elders, this is something that we're giving a lot of our time and attention to, is just do the shepherding care part of our role as best we can. And then providing opportunities to serve. Pastor Manoj has really taken the lead on this, as well as some of you. And that's been one of the really exciting things, is to watch many of you who are deeply engaged in various kinds of, I guess you can call them, ministries, organizations out in the community, who have been willing to say, yeah, I would love to be a connector between our church, the resources we have, the time, energy, financial resources that we have, and these various things going on in the community. And so that's beginning to happen, which is really beautiful. You've seen Pastor Manoj up here several times already this year, kind of sharing, hey, here's a need with a partner. And you guys have met those needs, which is really cool. One of the goals of that whole service team is that our community would increasingly see Jacob's Well as kind of a first stop when there's needs. I serve on one of the North Brunswick town committees, the housing committee. And I was sitting in a meeting once, and they were like, oh, we're going to need a lot of volunteers for this. And they said, just call the Little League. And by that, they meant the Little League. As soon as they send a call out, they get tons of volunteers, and the Little League is like their first, emergency. We need something quick. I was like, oh, that would be said of Jacob's Well, right? Like, oh, no, we need 20 people on a set. Oh, Jacob's Well, like, that's one of our little visions for our team, is that we would be a first stop. And so really excited for what God is doing there. So those things are happening. I mean, that's kind of what I'm happy to report. There's no huge course corrections that we're doing. We're kind of moving forward with these things. In many ways, what that slide represents to me is a lot of names of leaders who have stepped into those roles and are really taking those and running them. You know, I think of the discipleship team, the care team, the community team, the service team, right? Like, those are all fairly new in the last year or two. These are, like, good things that have actually come from COVID, is us really needing to rethink some of our leadership needs and launching more and more people to go lead, in a season where we're all kind of exhausted. We all have only so much capacity. It's cool to see people stepping in and saying, I'll take that, right? Like, I'll run with that responsibility. When those opportunities are put before the church, if you have capacity, if you're willing, if the Lord tugs on your heart, just put a hand up and say, I can meet that need this week. I know that many of us feel like I can't promise much beyond a week or two, but when we can, just jumping in together is just a really beautiful thing. I have no idea what the next slide is, but we'll run with it. Oh, giving. We only do this twice a year. I don't get up here every Sunday and say, give, but I do it twice a year, so give. We do need you to give, right? All of these things take financial provision. And so one of the realities of the kind of just growth pattern that we've experienced is we've had some people who have left in the midst of COVID. We've had many of you come in. Is our church has never been a church that is like solely reliant on a couple people. We've always been a church that kind of generally is very generous, which is one of the most beautiful things about our community over, what were we just saying the other day, 12, 13 years has it been, right? Which is crazy. But that's always been a pattern for us. And so if you're new here, if you're a member, you've been told, hey, this is an expectation we have, not in some weird way, not in some shakedown. We're going to, you know, track your giving and be weird about it. But we do ask that if you're locking arms with us, this is one of the practical ways to do that. And so if you find it difficult to even imagine what it might look like to give and be generous with church, this is something that we want to come alongside you in, not just so that, you know, our bottom line is increased or something, but that probably means that you could just use some help in general, whether financially, that we can meet some needs for you, or just kind of getting things together. We have really, you know, smart, organized, budget-driven kind of people who would love to sit with you and help you figure that out. But this is one of those times every year where I say, you know, members, we give you a deeper dive into finances. Right now, I'd say, like, we're okay. This isn't some, you know, cry for help or something. But this is always kind of a lull in the year for whatever reason. I don't know, maybe it's Christmas or whatever, but this is always a little bit of a lull. So it's a good time, actually, for me to stand in front of you and to just give that little prompting to say, if you want to give, here's how you do it. You click right there on our website. This is just what our website looked like, I don't know, 7 months ago. But go ahead and click where it says give. Go to the next slide. It'll take you to this slide. There's a spot on there where you can give a one-time gift. All of it's very obvious. But the circle, a little oblong circle there, is if you want to do recurring giving, which probably doesn't surprise you. That's the best thing. That's the easiest thing for us. That's the most helpful thing for us and most helpful for you. You kind of not set it and forget it. I wouldn't encourage you to forget it, but setting it is a wise spiritual practice. You can do recurring giving through that. If you have what's called a CCB login, I would imagine most of the room is like, what's CCB? It's this. You've probably seen this before if you've been around a little bit. It'll take you to this screen. If you don't have a login, there's instructions on there. Basically, Morgan will reach out to you or Nicole will reach out to you, give you a login. But if you do have a login, you go to this, and then there's another gift thing. It's pretty straightforward. That might look like a lot, but once you're clicking through, everything is right there for the taking. So would encourage you to give, right? One of our core identities we'll talk about in a couple weeks is joy and generosity and mission. We want to be a church. The kind of one-liner for that core identity has always been, we don't want anyone to ride the bench at Jacob's Well. Another sports analogy. There you go. I'm bracketing the talk in sports analogy. But no one rides the bench. And what we mean by that is we want everyone serving. We want everyone on some kind of Sunday team, putting their hands to the plow. But part of that is also about generosity, you know, being generous with what we have. And for some of you, that's financial generosity. For others, you know, your generosity is going to be expressed otherwise. But, right, this is just responding to Jesus's call that we tend to be people who look inward. We tend to be self-preservers. And he says your greatest joy is actually found in giving of yourself, in being freed to be someone who finds joy in giving. And so I think that's it, right, Mike? No, it's not. Of course it's not. Upcoming events, this is for your calendar's sake. I get a lot of credit. Probably the one that I would highlight on there, we've announced Sabbath dinner and community meal. The one that I would highlight on there is I get a lot of questions. When's discipleship course starting? When's discipleship course starting? Those are your dates. 2/16 to 4/6. I'll even give you like 30 seconds since, you know, last semester we had something like somewhere between 70 and 80% of our Sunday attenders did discipleship course, which is just kind of a cool number to hear. So that impacts the vast majority of you. So that's a good thing to put in your calendars now. Or do like Ellen's doing. That's an even better idea. Take a picture of it. Well done, Ellen. Those are your Good Friday and Easter dates. One other thing that I did want to mention is we have invited Ryan and Jenna Fisher. Jenna is our director of Well Kids. Ryan is her husband. We've asked them together to give some, not even some thought, give a lot of thought to honor the great work that they've done, to give thought to what we're calling youth ministry, and the working title of which is Well Teens. If you have a better name than that, feel free to let us know, though we probably maybe won't take your suggestion. But we're trying to figure that out. But they have given thought, right? We have always had this interesting reality where we got a lot of little kids, thus our Well Kids ministry, and then this gap. We have had a couple handfuls of middle schoolers and high schoolers, many of whom I am pleased to say are sitting among us our charter members being being Brianna J. Thomas, who went many, many years with no ministry to speak of for them, and they're here, which is awesome, and we love you guys. But we do see that, right, this huge influx of young people. And so Ryan and Jenna, I just met with them this week, not for the first time, you know, like we've been meeting, but they have a plan that they want to roll out. And so you'll be hearing about that in the next couple weeks. They want to meet with parents, kind of get a sense of who would want to be involved. What we're talking about here is after well kids, so sixth grade and on, so middle school and high school ministry, really excited about what they're doing. And so parents, when that call is put out, if you have a current middle schooler, high schooler, or you're going to have one, like I have a fifth grader who's going to be in sixth, I should be a part of that to hear what they'll be rolling out. They asked me to call it a rollout rather than a launch, because a launch just sounds so victorious. A rollout is more like a rollout, you know? So we got a lot to learn in this area. But again, Ryan and Jenna are kind of heading that up. That's it, right, Mike? There we go. Cool. This is who we are. This is what we're about, right? Like all of that amazingness of embodying who Jesus wants us to be does come down to us trying to radically do God's will through the everyday stuff that we do as a church. And so so we'd love for you to jump in with us. So, hey, here's what I say in order to introduce community today. Come see a man who will tell you everything you ever did and will love you to the deepest parts of who you are, in spite of it, because of it. And the way that he met our greatest need, this is one of the cool things about that story, right, is he's thirsty in that story, and then he says, I will quench your thirst. And there's one other time where we're told very explicitly Jesus is thirsty. When was that? On the cross, right? He says, I thirst on the cross, right? Like Jesus went into the full, desperate thirst of sin and shame and rebellion and death itself in order to give us that living water. Right? Because what all of that deserves is to be put away forever. And that means we deserve to be put away forever. Instead, Jesus went where we belong and then rose victorious such that we can have hope and newness of life. And so on the night before he was crucified, let me just say this. It is important. This meal is for this very, very modest meal. Is for followers of Jesus. If you're not a follower of Jesus, you honor him more by just considering everything that you've heard today. But if you are a follower of Jesus, you're welcome to join and participate in this. Jesus took bread at the table, and he said, this is my body broken for you, my life for your life, my death for your death, such that you can have hope. He said, take of it in remembrance of me. The same way he took wine that was at the table, and he said, this represents my blood poured out. Real suffering for the suffering of this world. The blood of a new covenant, a new relationship that we can have with him. Take it in remembrance of me. I welcome the worship team up now. Would you just take a moment where you're seated?